Menopause, perimenopause, these can be some of the most uncomfortable phases of a woman's life. If you find yourself in either of these, well, Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it really shows.
And get this, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it is perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold.
And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. For many of us, the topic of self-care includes eating healthy and working out. But when you get busy, don't forget about your mental well-being as well. Therapy isn't for only those who've experienced a major trauma. For me, it's a tool to manage my stress and work on being the best version of myself.
So whether you are looking for a new therapist or trying therapy for the first time, BetterHelp is, well, here to help. Their online appointments are designed to be convenient for your schedule, and all you need to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And you can switch therapists at any time.
BetterHelp makes it easy to make your mental well-being part of your regular self-care regimen. So why not try BetterHelp? Take care of your body and your brain.
Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/dress today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/dressed. Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dress, the History of Fashion, a podcast where we explore the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Dress listeners, welcome back to part two of our conversation with Dr. Elizabeth L. Block, who joined us on Wednesday to discuss her recently published book, Beyond Vanity, The History and Power of Hairdressing, which is an incredibly well-researched, captivating, and diverse history about women's hair and the cultural power that hairdressing held in 19th century America.
On Wednesday's episode, we learned about the significance of women's hair to 19th century American society and its intimate connection to a woman's social status and respectability. We then looked at the hairdressing profession itself and what we could have expected had we been a customer at one of the many hair emporiums or parlors throughout the U.S. at this time. And we also met the sought-after African-American hairdresser Eliza Potter, whose profession took her into the private lives and affairs of white upper-class society. And this is something that she shared about in her tell-all memoir, A Hairdresser's Experience in High Life, where, as we like to say, Cass, she spilled the tea on American high society at that time.
Yes, she did. And just a little teaser on my promised upcoming episode on Eliza and her memoir. In the book's preface, she writes, quote, "My avocation calls me into the upper classes of society almost exclusively, and there reign as many elements of misery as the world can produce. No one need go into alleys to hunt up wretchedness. They can find it in perfection among the rich and fashionable of every land and nation. Oh, if tessellated hearths and satin tapestries could speak, what tales of agony they might tell. If the marble statues that adorn the riches of lordly mansions could open their mouths, how would they outrival all poetry and romance in the incidents they could proclaim? And could the nuptial couch with its silken hangings unfold its memory? Could we bear to listen to its disclosures? But nowhere do hearts betray themselves more unguardedly than in the private boudoir, where the hairdresser's mission makes her a daily attendant. Why then should not the hairdresser write, as well as the physician and clergyman? She will tell her story in simpler language, but it will be nonetheless truthful, nonetheless strange."
Wow. So has much really changed? You know, like that whole culture of sitting down in the hairdresser's chair and just
spilling your guts.
Dumping everything out on them. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So just little teaser, dress listeners, very much looking forward to bringing you some stories from the boudoir's tessellated hearths and satin tapestries coming your way to a dress podcast episode soon.
But first, let's meet some of Eliza's contemporaries, a few of the other incredible women entrepreneurs who carved out very successful careers as hairdressers and or purveyors of hair care products during the 19th century, as well as many of the women who supplied the hair for the international hair trade and market. Liz, welcome back for part two.
Elizabeth, welcome back to Dressed.
Thank you.
I mean, there was so much more to say. There was no way we were ever going to put it into one episode. So I'm so pleased you're joining me again today. Back to your wonderful book, you write a lot about the opportunities hairdressing and the hair care industry afforded women. And this was a market that Black women entrepreneurs in particular excelled in by marketing hair care products to Black consumers. So they're really tapping into a previously untapped or ignored market, and they become incredibly successful because of it. As you write in the book, there are near complete biographies of several women in the hair industry, and that, of course, includes Madam C.J. Walker, who we have done an episode on, Dress Listeners. If you've not heard it, listen to it. It's fantastic. Really fascinating hair care industry pioneer in the early 20th century. But there are several others, as you attest to. And I'd love if you could please introduce us to one of Madam C.J. Walker's predecessors, Christiana Carteau Bannister.
Christiana Carteau Bannister is one of the hero figures of my book. She was a hairdressing entrepreneur in Boston and Providence, Rhode Island. And this is before we even think of hairdressing entrepreneurs. Like you said, thankfully, Madam C.J. Walker has become a known figure, you know, almost a household name for people who are interested in early 20th century history. And there was even a show called Self-Made on Netflix, which was really fascinating and tracks Madam C.J. Walker's life. So she was a millionaire, a Black woman millionaire in the early 20th century. But as you say, during my research, I found a few figures, specifically Carteau Bannister, who is an entrepreneur in the hair space 3 decades before Madam C.J. Walker. So even possibly 4 decades. So she starts in the 1860s. She is a woman of mixed race. She's of African and Native American descent. She owned hair rooms, so proto salons, in 2 different cities, and she sold her own products. Now, how did I find her to begin with? This goes back to my art historian roots, but I was studying her husband, Edward Mitchell Bannister, who was a Black man from Canada. And he is a landscape painter who's fairly well known in art historical circles. So I was studying him, and one of the main pieces of his biography is that he started his career as a barber, so doing men's hair. And how did he become independent enough from the barbering work to become a landscape painter? Well, it was through his wife, Christiana Carteau. She became so successful in her hairdressing services and her product line that she was able to support her husband in his painting career. So, I mean, that alone. So tracking her services, you can see all the advertisements she ran in the newspapers, aimed for Black readers, but also in the Liberator in Boston. Her services included, she did offer hair cutting, hair dressing, dyeing, shampooing, and also wig making. She offered it all. She sold her own hair restorative. So a restorative is a type of hair product that is a little difficult to figure out exactly what it is, but I think it probably was like a styler today. So something with a slicker base to it, rather than a tonic, but really all of these restoratives were filled with alcohol. Anyway, in her advertising, she claimed that it was made from, quote, the roots and herbs of the forest. And her shampoo that she sold was made from tree bark, and it was said to ward off gray hair, like all the other products right out there, pretty much. But she really went hard in the advertising space with her products. And then speaking of space, she moved freely through space. And I just love this concept of the mobility of her life. She traveled freely between Boston and Providence, where she had clients in both cities. She supported her family. She and her husband did not have children, but she had a broad extended family. When she sold her products, she was selling them through the hair rooms that she rented in both of these cities. And remarkably, what I love in her advertisements is that she tells her clients in Boston when she will be leaving Boston to go do hair in Providence and vice versa, so that people know where to find her and when she'll be returning. So it's basically like, your hairdresser's going out of town. Don't call for an appointment until they get back. So we can all identify with that. But she didn't want to miss out on sales of her products. So in her advertisements, she would say, oh, and you can get my restorer at Mrs. Smith's down the hall. So go down there. Like my hair rooms will be locked, but go down the hall and don't forget to buy them there. So just incredibly entrepreneurial and really a terrific figure in this time period.
Yeah, absolutely. And something else that you talk about in the book is, and Madam C.J. Walker is representative of this as well, is that Christiana's influence extended well beyond just hairdressing. For instance, Christiana was a community organizer, activist, she was an abolitionist, and her salon was this important community meeting ground, which of course these salons remain these important community meeting spaces to this very day. And as you write, it was a lively center of social and civic activity. And I just think that's really significant in terms of the history of hair too. And talking about moving beyond aesthetics is that these places where hair was being done are these important meeting grounds for women.
That's right. Her hair spaces, her salon was a community meeting place. There's records and documentation in the newspapers that emancipation groups were meeting there. This would be early in her career, obviously, and coming to meet and coming to speak. She would have guest speakers there. This is salon life before we even really get salon life as we know it. The contemporary concept of the beauty salon really comes in the early 20th century and reaches a pinnacle, say, in the 1950s, where you would go and you would never do your hair at home. You would only get your hair done at the salon. And that's where you would go to socialize and to exchange information with neighbors and friends. And of course, gossip happened there too. But also thinking about like 1960s, 1970s, where were the places of activist movements and liberation movements? A lot of conversation happens in salons and barbershops. And that was happening all the way back in 1860s, 1870s with Carteau Bannister.
And then just a quick shout out, address listeners, if you want to know more on that specific topic, Tiffany M. Gill's book, Beauty Shop Politics, African-American Women's Activism in the Beauty Industry, is a really significant, important work on that very topic. So definitely check it out. And I'll put a link in our show notes as well. Okay, so as mentioned, women taking up space and how they take up that space is one of the central themes of your book. And it's something that is certainly at the heart of your fifth chapter, which provides a really fascinating analysis of the so-called new woman of the last quarter of the 19th century. So for those of us who do not know, who was the new woman, the so-called new woman, because this is a contemporary term, and why was hair so significant to this societal phenomenon?
The new woman aesthetic comes in at the turn of the 20th century, and the phrase captures the image of the independent woman, like Mrs. Phelps Stokes in the painting by John Singer Sargent at the Met, who participated in sports like tennis and field hockey and badminton and hiking, and who was riding bicycles and was the picture of health. The new woman might also be a college student, or joining a profession like teaching or nursing or social work, or advocating for suffrage and for other political and social policies. Many of the so-called new women were derided in the press and in caricatures, and mostly by men who thought that this independent type of woman was not going to bear children and who was a threat to men and who smoked cigarettes and were seen as deviant and threatening to the concept of families. But for our purposes of the world of hair, the image of this woman took hold through illustrations by really terrific artists like Howard Chandler Christie, Harrison Fisher, and especially Charles Dana Gibson for magazines, popular magazines like Collier's and The Century, The Ladies' Home Journal, and also for Life magazine. And you get this subcategory of the new women called the Gibson Girl, which results from the type of woman that was being drawn and circulated by Charles Dana Gibson. They're really fun illustrations. So this woman was envisioned to be tall and lean and a little athletic and would wear kind of roomy, comfortable clothes for the day and kind of representing the amount of agency that they had at this period, at the turn of the century. And the hairstyle needed to match this aura. So for the hairstyle, the new woman was adopting the airy bouffant style. It is an upswept spherical hairdo, which you could achieve with less hair than the other earlier updos earlier in the century that we were talking about. So when I mentioned that you wanted to have long hair, like past your shoulders, even past your waist, it was because you needed enough hair to build up the hairstyles with lots of braiding and lots of and twisting and volume that you needed earlier in the century. But for the Gibson girl or the new woman bouffant, you could do it with less hair. So you could have your hair a little bit shorter, which was more practical if you were a woman who was doing lots of outdoor activities and activities outside the home. So this airy bouffant was achieved by swooping, combing your hair upward toward the top middle of the crown of your head, and you would knot it up there at the middle. And if you didn't have enough volume in your natural hair, you could implant or set a rat in various places on your scalp to get the volume. So a rat is made by sewing a piece of satin or silk around hair combings, maybe your own hair combings that would be puffy and could fill this piece of satin or silk. Or if you didn't have enough of your own natural hair combings, you could fill it with artificial hair or another type of material. And you would place those on your head and then pin them and swoop the hair over them. So it's like a spherical, airy, shorter hairstyle. And it resonates with the pneumatics, I think, of air-filled tires on bicycles.
Yeah, I was going to say bicycles is certainly one of those things that's synonymous with the new woman at this time and her greater visibility in society.
That's right. That's right. And also hair, you mentioned hats, and the hat styles get smaller too. So for the new woman who's up on a bicycle, she might be wearing a small straw hat or a boater hat, which was used for bicycling. And in the painting of Mrs. Phelps Stokes, she's holding one of those type of straw hats in her right hand.
Yeah. And I also just, on a very random side note, dress listeners, is when I think of this period, I always think of The Wizard of Oz because her aunt is wearing exactly what you just described on
That's
a bicycle.
Right.
Yeah. If anyone needs an immediate reference.
Love the visual. Love the visual.
Cass, did you know that learning a new language is only helpful for international travel? Acquiring new language skills also has cognitive benefits and can improve brain function. Studies have shown that learning a new language can improve memory, problem-solving skills, and even delay the onset of dementia.
There are so many reasons to learn a new language, dress listeners, and Rosetta Stone has been the trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. Available to use on a desktop or an app, Rosetta Stone is flexible for when you want to learn fast by immersion.
With features like True Accent that gives you feedback on your pronunciation, to the fact that you get lifetime access to all of Rosetta Stone's 25 languages, this incredible offer solves all your language learning needs for life.
Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. Dress listeners, we know from experience that getting started investing can feel confusing. Especially with so many options out there, many people tend to put it off. but it does not need to be intimidating.
Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. And you don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you.
Acorns offers a learning platform for anyone wanting to learn more about investing strategies and also offers ESG portfolios, which invest your money in companies rated for their impact on environment, social, and governance issues, something that you know we love on Dressed.
So what are you waiting for? Head to acorns.com/dressed or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing in your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/trust. Artifact Uprising wants to help you preserve your meaningful moments this holiday season. Whether you want to say I love you with the perfect gift, display favorite memories in your home, or connect with loved ones throughout the year, they have a product you can personalize.
Yes, so many wonderful products, and that even includes baby board books, which is something that I recently personalized for my 2-year-old son, Leo, who loves to read. And I titled the book A Boy Named Leo. And the best part is that it all comes illustrated with some of my favorite pictures of him by himself and with family and friends. It really is such a sweet, unique, and special commemoration of our life together thus far, and something we will all cherish forever.
Artifact Uprising makes it easy to tell your story. Through the end of the year, Dressed listeners can give Artifact Uprising a try and get 20% off for new customers or 15% off if you have purchased before. Just visit artifactuprising.com and use the code DRESSED through December 31st.
You also write about in this section how the hair stories of actress Minnie Matern-Fisk encapsulate the cultural work that New Women hairstyles embodied and symbolized. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
Minnie Matern-Fisk is an actress, and she wears more of a pompadour style. So we just talked about the bouffant style of the New Woman, but simultaneous with that style is this pompadour style, which is not like the 1950s, like Greece pompadour, but it's more of a hairstyle that is, it's very front forward, forehead forward. So you would pin your hair up in the back and then have curls around your forehead. And it was also a poofy style. And Minnie Matern-Fisk is a redhead, and she is on stage, and she wears her hair in this fashion forward pompadour and becomes identified with it. Because actresses with hairstyles, as they were with fashion styles, they would be wearing their hair in a certain way and influencing the society at large. And this is because their image would circulate. So even if you didn't see Fisk in a theatrical performance, you might see her hairstyle in a trade card that would be making its way around for a certain performance or reproduced in a magazine or a newspaper. That's how the styles would disseminate. But she was, a fashion forward and an actress like Sarah Bernhardt, who was also a redhead, who set many hairstyles depending on how her hair was behaving that day. She famously had kind of frizzy red hair, and it's shown in lots of different styles, depending on who the artist is who's conveying her image.
And of course, speaking to also, she's just one of the many fashion icons who is significant in circulating popular hairstyles and ensuring they are adopted across the social strata at this time. And your sixth and final chapter provides a fascinating analysis of the international hair trade market. And this is something that you make clear in your book that was at the time riddled with racist, sexist, classist stereotypes and really patronizing perspectives. But something that I really appreciate about your work, and it's something in academia we call reading against the grain of your source material. Right. So source material is intended to be read a certain way. It's intended to reflect these biases, et cetera. But you're kind of reading against that. And you do an incredible job of doing that to find the human element of the trade and to humanize the trade, especially through the lived experiences of the women working in it. Can you introduce us to this international trade and then introduce us to some of these women?
Thank you for that. It was extremely important to me to get to the bottom of the workings of the raw hair trade and to humanize what actually went on during it. The international trade in raw hair, so raw hair was being sold and bought for extensions and sew-ins and for wigs, so augmentations to natural hair, which I have been mentioning was so important to achieving some of these updo styles. But the international trade in the hair is incredibly obscure in the archives for the 19th century. It was referred to for a long time as a, quote, unusual trade or a strange trade. It was mysterious. It is absolutely not well documented. The newspaper reports that I found state false figures all the time that do not match with city and state and country records. I really went deep into this one. But the hair trade was a huge market. So the United States bought raw hair from France, Italy, Russia, Germany, especially Norway and Sweden, and several others. And you can read in the book about which of the countries were the most popular. But what was interesting to me was to get out of these numbers and these charts and these misstatements in all of these official records and newspapers, because they were unreliable. But what's always reliable is looking at human beings and looking at their faces, looking at their hair, looking at their bodily movements. And one way I did this was to use photographs that were in a newspaper spread that is extremely biased and really awfully just very classist about young women in Brittany, France, who would sell their hair to traveling itinerant hair buyers. And remarkably, in these photographs, you can see the faces. You can even see, even though they're in black and white, you can see that some of these young girls had blonde hair, like almost white hair, that was really privileged at the time and was considered to be the most valuable hair. But what I did was look closely at their faces, look at how old they were. Some of these girls were like 9, 10 years. They're there with older women, either mothers or caretakers or grandmothers or neighbors, and looking at their expressions and imagining what was it like to go to the hair market that day. So the hair market might be once every 6 months or once every 9 months, and you could go after growing your hair through the year. You could get your hair cut and sell lengths. You wanted to sell more than 6 inches at a time and get paid for your hair. And I start to imagine in my writing, what did these young women think on hair market day? No one's smiling, but you rarely get people smiling in newspaper photographs. What must they have been thinking? How long did they grow their hair? What were they thinking of buying with the money that they got from selling their hair, a piece of jewelry or a piece of clothing, a garment? Did they talk and compare the color of their hair? Did they compare the growth speed of their hair? So what must it have been like?
And you just did really an incredible job of bringing a new perspective to these images. And not just this aspect of the book, but throughout the entire book. I think listeners, you're going to be really impressed and pleasantly surprised by the range of stories told in this book. I found, for one, found it incredibly unexpected, Liz, and I really appreciated the story you told. So thank you so much for giving us this book and this insight into this little studied period in hair history. And you've been incredibly generous with your time, so I'm not going to keep you much longer. But in closing, what do you ultimately hope readers will take away from the book?
So, you know, the book is about women's lives and paying attention to how women spend their time and the place and space that they take up. But it is also really a love letter to hairdressers, to all the folks out there in the hairdressing world who contribute to the world of self-care in a way that doesn't get the attention that, say, a couture designer does. And I hope that our episodes will reach the hairdressers of the world as well.
Yes, I think that is a guarantee. So thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you. It was such a joy and a privilege.
Liz, thank you so much for providing these incredibly fascinating insights into your book. And Cass, the international hair market history is super fascinating, especially when you put it in the context of the global hair, wigs, and extensions market, which in 2023 had an estimated value of $4.3 billion last year.
Whoa.
And thus we said that it's still not far from controversy today, that we still see that time and time again, especially in terms of the ethics of the supply chain, which spans the globe.
Yes, and I did do a little bit more research into this, and there's a 2016 book that I want to get my hands on called Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Hair. It's by social anthropologist Emma Tarlow, who traveled the globe meeting people around the world whose livelihoods depends on hair and this hair market. And as the book blurb reads, quote, "Viewed from inside Chinese wig factories, Hindu temples in the villages of Myanmar, or from Afro hair fairs, Jewish wig parlors, fashion salons, and hair loss clinics in Britain and the United States, hair is oddly revealing of the lives of all it touches."
And a theme that is certainly underscored in Liz's book, Beyond Vanity, the history and power of hairdressing. I mean, who knew that so many stories could literally be braided into one's hair, Cass?
Well, that does it for us today, dress listeners. May you consider the stories woven into your clothes or dressed into your hair next time you get dressed.
Remember, we love hearing from you, so if you'd like to write to us, you can do so at hello@dressedhistory.com. You can also DM us on Instagram @dressed_podcast, which is where you'll find posts and reels to accompany each week's episodes. If you're looking for content specific to this episode, it can be found at #dressed510 and #dressed511.
And also be sure and check out Liz's Instagram @ElizabethLBlock.
Also, if you need some fall reading, you can find a link in our show notes that will take you to our dressed bookshelf at bookshop.org, where you will find both of Liz's books, Beyond Vanity and Dressing Up, along with over, at this point now, Cass, 150 of other fashion history titles.
Yes, and you can find a link to that website in our show notes, where you can also find a link to our website, dressedhistory.com, where you can check out our latest offerings from the dress universe. That includes our ongoing classes and tours, which of course you can sign up for April's Fashion History Fridays at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City for a 90-minute tour of the Met's most fashionable masterpieces, starting in the ancient world all the way into the 20th century. Although April, you are about to, and I know this, head with me to Paris.
Yes. And so that means that my Met tours for October and most of November 2024 are going to be on pause in New York City. But I do have some things up my sleeve if you happen to find yourself in Paris at that time. So head over to dressedhistory.com maybe in a couple weeks or so to learn more about Paris offerings.
And do you love dress, but do you want to skip the ads? Consider subscribing to our ad-free version of the show for just $3 a month and enjoy our 8 new episodes a month ad-free. Well, that does it for us today, dress listeners. Thank you as always for tuning in, and more dress coming your way very soon. Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of Dressed Media.
During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.